think the same thing happens here in the book of Revelation. Rather than describing the people of God as this massive power that's greater ultimately than Rome, it's described as these four living creatures. And many of the things that are said about these, I think, make it very clear that you are talking about those that are capable of worship, those that are really people. And I think that serves as a beautiful kind of image. Now, that brings us to what we found at the beginning of chapter 6, in which there are a number of seals that are open. Now, I've tried to suggest to you that I think, rather than really trying to allow ourselves to get bogged down with trying to figure out and isolate every single figure, it's my conviction that the book of Revelation is not really written with the intention of every little figure having a great deal of significance. In other words, if you read from some denominational sources, you'll find people that will try to, first of all, they don't view this as something that applies to the persecution that was taking place then. Most of them will try to look ahead and say, okay, well, this is World War II, or this is a World War III kind of scenario, something like that. Whereas if you look at the very beginning of the book, it describes it as being descriptive of those things that must shortly take place or come to pass. If that's the case, then what we're seeing in this book is not so much something that we have to try to identify, well, is this Russia or is this the former Soviet Union? But rather, we see symbols and figures of persecution, oppression, and then the deliverance of God and the deliverance of His people. Now, I want to spend just a minute before we get into the text. We're in Revelation chapter 6 and verse 9, where we've looked at a number of these seals that describe different kinds of hardships, different kinds of victories. And we came down to verse 9, where we'll have the fifth seal and the cry of these martyrs under the altar. But before we even look at that, I want to set the stage for this a little bit by looking at some examples of how God has communicated in the past. Because I think, while if you just open Revelation without any previous context, it might seem very confusing, and it might seem that it's an enigma that's impossible to unravel. But let's remind ourselves of the way God's communicated in the past. Look back in Genesis 37. Genesis 37 for a minute. I've made reference to this both in our study of the book of Daniel just before we began the book of Revelation. And I've made reference to this in sermons as well. Genesis chapter 37. I want us to look first in chapter 37 and then in chapter 41 at two instances in which God reveals something to first His people and then to even an enemy king. But it is the interpretation of that is given by one of God's people. Joseph is involved in both of these situations. Would someone read for us, please, Genesis 37, verse 5 down through verse 10? Volunteer for that. Genesis 37, verse 5 down through verse 10. Chuck. Yes, please.
And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brethren, and they hated him, yet they hated him. And he said unto them, "Hear, I pray you, this dream which I've dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. Behold, your sheaf stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf." And his brethren said to him, "Shalt thou indeed reign over us? Or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us?" And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream and told it to his brethren. He said, "Behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me." And he told it to his father and to his brethren. Father rebuked him and said unto him, "What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and my mother, thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth?"
Okay. Now, you know, it's pretty easy for us to look at this and see, and I think it was easy for Joseph's brothers to look at this and to see the significance of this, and for Jacob to look at this and see the significance. The sheaves, this is not describing some instances in which God will animate unthinking sheaves. The sheaves represent what? His brothers. Sheaves represent his brothers. Same way with the stars and the sun and the moon. What are they representative of? mother, father, his brothers as well. So here we see that this is indicative of what will take place one day, of course, when he is when he's sold into slavery into Egypt and then one day comes to power. It will, in fact, be fulfilled that his own family will bow down before him. And this is revealed prophetically, but it is revealed with figures of speech. I look at this and I'm reminded of what we have looked at in the book of Revelation, where we see people figured as living creatures with the appearance of a lion or the appearance of an eagle. It doesn't have to be that these things are literally describing, again, a sheaf literally bound down, but it becomes a figure for something that will take place. Look at another one. Look over in chapter 41. Chapter 41. Here, the example of a dream that Pharaoh has. Would someone read for us, please, Genesis 41, 15 through 28?
Verse 15 through 28.
Everybody volunteer for this? Okay, Patrick.
And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. But I have heard it said to you that you can understand the dream to interpret it. So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, behold, in my dream I stood on the bank of the river. Suddenly seven cows came up out of the river, fine looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. And behold, seven other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt, such ugliness as I have never seen in all the lands of Egypt. And the gaunt and ugly cows ate up the first seven, the fat cows. When they had eaten them up, no one would have known that they had eaten them, for they were just as ugly as the beginning. So I awoke. Also I saw in my dream, and seven heads came up on one stalk. Then behold, seven heads with withered, thin, and blighted by the east wind sprang up after them. And the thin heads devoured the seven good heads. So I told this to the magicians, but there was no one who could explain it to me. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, the dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. And the seven thin and ugly cows which came up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. How far did you say?
Just the 28, please.
This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh that he is what he is about to do.
Okay. Now, notice in this as well, you find figurative language. You're not literally talking about some situation, even though it's describing a famine. It's not going to be a famine in which cows that are not carnivorous begin to be carnivorous. That's not the point here. The point is that this becomes a figure of the nature of this famine that's coming. What a hardship it will be, that it will be something that will last. The number becomes significant here because that's the number that's connected with it. But I want you to notice one other thing about this, too, that I think is significant. This kind of comes in pairs, doesn't it? Sort of the same way that Joseph's dream earlier, in pairs, to illustrate the same thing in a couple of different ways. I think both of those things are important for us to think about as we consider, here's how God in the past has communicated his plans, has communicated something that's going to take place. Now, if we can get that picture in our mind, I don't think it's going to give us quite as much difficulty when we get to the book of Revelation, when there may be some times that it will talk about a hardship and a deliverance, followed by a hardship and a deliverance. We don't have to see this as a timeline in which you're going to have, all right, well, this is the middle age. You don't have to do it that way, I don't think. Instead, I think the symbol becomes hardship, deliverance, persecution, deliverance. And even if it one follows the other, I don't see the indications necessarily that we have to see it in a historical timeline, but rather just indications of the same thing. Now I want to look at one other thing, but thoughts or comments or questions before we pass by these dreams as an illustration of figurative language. Okay, look at one last thing. And that is what we could refer to as eschatological language. That's a fancy word that just means end times language. Now, there's an awful lot of times in the New Testament that we will see examples of eschatological language, where it'll talk about darkening of the bodies within the heavens, the moon turning to blood, things like that. Perhaps one of the most familiar is in Acts chapter 2. And you remember in Acts chapter 2, there is a connection with a prophecy that comes in the Old Testament. And what's very significant about what happens in Acts chapter 2 is particularly this language that you'll notice here. And I want to just point out a little something to you there in Acts chapter 2. When Peter stands up on the day of Pentecost and describes what's taking place, they're speaking in tongues. You'll remember he quotes from Joel chapter 2. And specifically notice, if you would, verse 19 and 20 of Acts chapter 2. It says, "And I will show wonders in the heavens above and signs in the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and notable day of the Lord." And you'll notice then, if we were to continue to read, that it is Peter is describing, and in fact he began this by saying right at the beginning when he stood up, that this is what was spoken. Now, obviously, on the day of Pentecost, these signs in the heavens did not literally take place. We know from 2 Peter that one day, absolutely, this universe, this heaven and earth will be dissolved, will pass away. But here as a description of the significance of what was taking place on the day of Pentecost, Peter says what Joel said would happen, it's happening right now. And Joel chapter 2 is where that's described. Now, that's not an isolated example. I want you to look at two. First, go to Isaiah chapter 13 for a minute. Isaiah chapter 13. And what we're considering here is just how we looked first at how God has used figurative language to reveal things prophetically. But I want us to think now about the way in which he has used often end times language or eschatological language to describe things that are significant moments in history. Isaiah chapter 13, verse 1, identifies the things that are going to follow by saying, "The burden against Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos saw." Now, of course, Babylon doesn't exist anymore, does it? Iraq is where Babylon used to be. But there is no power now that is Babylon, and there has not been to the same extent since the fall of that kingdom that began with Nebuchadnezzar. But take a look. Would someone read for us verse 9 and 10? Verse 9 and 10 of Isaiah 13. Okay, Jack. Now, here it's in connection with this description of the downfall of Babylon, but it connects this end times language. Now, I personally think that it's not so simple as just to say, well, it's just a hyperbole. I think there are times that God will use a description of a very significant thing that's going to happen by describing some of those things that one day will happen. Now, that doesn't make it just purely hyperbole. Some will say that all of these things are just exaggerations to make the point. Well, that would make even descriptions later on in the New Testament just exaggerations. But there will one day be a time when this world comes to an end. There will one day be a time when the sun will no longer give its light. The moon won't reflect that light. But I think here we see that this language can be used of things that don't necessarily have to mean that the world comes to an end or that even these literal signs in the heaven appear. Rather, it is describing a significant act of judgment that takes place at the time. Look at one other example. Ezekiel chapter 32. Ezekiel chapter 32. Very similar kind of situation with a very similar kind of foe that is being rebuked or a burden given to them. Here it's described as a lamentation. Ezekiel chapter 32. And we'll notice, just like we saw in Isaiah 13, there is an identifier of who this is directed to in verse 2. And I can't get my pages turned. There we are. Son of man, take up a lamentation for Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and say to him, you are like a young lion among the nations, and you are like a monster in the seas, bursting forth in your rivers, troubling the waters with your feet, and fouling their rivers. So here's who it's talking to. It's talking to Pharaoh. Is there a Pharaoh today? No, there's no more Pharaoh today, is there? There's still an ancient of Egypt, but not the same way that we're talking about here. Now, somebody read for us, please, verse 6 through 8. Verse 6 through 8. Volunteer for that? Okay, Eddie.
I will also water the land with the flow of your blood, even to the mountains, and the riverbeds will be full of you. When I put out your light, I will cover the heavens and make its stars dark, and I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give her light. All the bright lights of the heavens I will make dark over you, and bring darkness upon your land, says the Lord God.
Okay. Now, you may have some hyperbole here. I don't know that there's a description of blood coming to the mountains on Day of Judgment. But here we see the same kind of thing. The downfall of Egypt is pictured with the bodies within the heavens no longer shining forth, no longer giving their light in the same way. Now, we may have taken a long way to get there.
Now turn over to Revelation chapter 6.
Because I think if we look at it from this background, and see that God has communicated His judgment and His will and His purposes, not only with figures of speech, corn stalks, sheaves, gaunt cows, that kind of thing, but also He's communicated significant acts of judgment with end times language, darkening of the sun, darkening of the moon. I think that helps us to understand some things we're going to notice here in the next few verses. Would somebody read for us in Revelation chapter 6, verse 9 down through verse 11?
The fifth seal. Volunteer for that? Anybody? Okay.
Get, Jeff.
When you opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a loud voice, saying, how long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who fell on the earth?
Okay. Now, this description here of these souls under the altar has troubled some, particularly in light of what Scripture teaches about the realm of the dead that is described in Scripture as Hades. The Old Testament uses the term Sheol, New Testament uses the term Hades. The New Testament makes it pretty clear. Luke chapter 16, for example, when one dies, whether they are good or whether they are evil, they go into the land of Hades. There's a separation there. But, as we'll see when we get to the last couple of chapters of Revelation, death and Hades one day will give up the dead that are in them and stand before God in judgment. Some have struggled with this because here, as we see this vision that John beholds, of these things in heaven, he sees these souls under the altar that cry out, how long? And many have said, well, that seems to say that there are those in heaven already. And I don't think that we necessarily have to understand it that way, have to understand it as reversing the whole idea of Hades that's taught. If that's the case, we have a hard time understanding what will be said at the end of the book, where it does describe death and Hades giving up the dead in them. I think rather this is simply a way of describing, yes, there are those that died for their testimony. There are those who, on the earth, it may look as if they were defeated. On the earth, it may look as if they their cause was put down. But they are before the altar. They are in the presence of God. I don't think this contradicts the Hadean teaching. I think here, if we're going to literally figure out where they are, I think their souls are waiting in Hades for the resurrection. Part of the reason I say that is the very fact that they are told here to wait. They are told that there'll be this delay of judgment that will come. They are told to rest. And I think that's indicative of the kind of language that's often used of the dead awaiting resurrection, the dead awaiting judgment. But I think the main point here is God is not oblivious to persecution of his people. God is not blind to the fact that there have been those who've died for the cause of truth and the cause of Christ. And one day, they'll be avenged. One day, they will be vindicated for the suffering that they have undergone. Thoughts or comments, Chuck? And, you know, another passage that folks have struggled with when Paul will talk about his desire to depart and be with the Lord. Some have thought, well, maybe that means that they go right to heaven. I don't see anything that indicates that in Abraham's bosom there is not some sort of
association with God
or some sort of association with the Lord. Right, right. There is comfort. There is rest. You know, the beggar in the account of the rich man and Lazarus, there he was not, his suffering was brought to an end. He was put in the position of comfort. Any other thoughts or comments? All right, would someone read for us through the end of the chapter, verse 12 down to verse 17, the sixth seal? Now, here, hopefully you see some of the reason that we spent some time looking in Genesis and then looking in Isaiah and Ezekiel. Because you see some end times language here, don't you? And I don't know if the way in which we should understand this is descriptive of those things that one day will happen at the end, or if it is simply using it the way Isaiah did, using it the way Ezekiel did. Part of the reason that we may have some difficulty with this. When we get into chapter 7, it will talk about some things he saw after that. And then it's kind of as if things are starting over again. And that's why I made the point that often the Lord seems to kind of communicate the same thing in a couple of different ways. And I think that that's a little bit of what we're going to see here in the next chapter. But it certainly describes God's judgment of people. You know, just before this, with the fifth seal, these martyrs cried out, "How long will you ever avenge?" And then the very next seal is descriptive of God's power over all of creation. God's declaration of this power or demonstration of this power so that they want to hide. They want the mountains to fall on them rather than stand before the judgment of God. And certainly there will be a time, you know, at the beginning of the book of Revelation. It was described that even those who pierced him, he's coming on the clouds, and even those who pierced him, one day will see him. Even if you've been one who's a persecutor of God's people, if you've been one who's denied the Lord, if you've been one who has completely rejected him, one day you'll stand before him, and one day you'll see him. And I have no doubt, please don't go away from this class thinking, well, Brother Pope doesn't think that one day the earth is going to be brought to an end. Absolutely not. I think one day it will. But there are plenty of times when God has used that kind of end times language to simply describe his judgment upon those that were oppressors of his people. Thoughts or comments or questions down through the end of chapter 6, Brother Munden?
And for some kind of forgiveness,
I think that's a very good point. And I that in my own mind helps me reconcile sometimes when we'll have language like this. For example, Matthew chapter 24, people struggle over that a great deal, you know, because there'll be times when here they're talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and then it uses end times language like this. So some will either say, well, it's just talking about that, or it's just talking about the end of the world. I liken it a little bit, and this is probably not a good illustration, but my great-grandmother lived to be 100 years old. And it was very interesting because when you go to visit her in some of her last years, she could not remember who had been to see her the day before, but she could talk to you about things in her childhood as if they were just right there. Now, I'm not at all suggesting that God has dementia, but if we can understand that in a human mind such as that, the past becomes almost as if it's right here, how can it be that much more difficult for us to understand an all-knowing God that can see the events that will happen 1,000 years from now as if they are right here? And I think that may be somewhat what we see happening here. You know, God can speak of his judgment upon Rome or his judgment upon Babylon or his judgment upon Egypt, but then also see his ultimate judgment upon mankind. And the language becomes intertwined sometimes. Thoughts or comments? All right, let's move into chapter 7 then. And this is a chapter that our Jehovah's Witness friends really enjoy, but I think they may misunderstand a few things within what's being said here. Would someone want to read for us down through about verse 8 of Revelation chapter 7? Revelation chapter 7, 1 through 8. Volunteer. I'll take it down. After these things, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, on the sea, or in any tree. Then I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth and the sea or the trees till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads." And I heard the number of those who were sealed. 144,000 of the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. Of the tribe of Judah, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Reuben, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Gad, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Asher, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Simeon, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Levi, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Issachar, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Joseph, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000 were sealed. Now, many of our Jehovah's Witness friends have looked at this, and I don't see where they draw this kind of conclusion. But in their belief that there is not going to be a common destiny for those that are saved, but that there will be a rejuvenated earth that's just kind of like this earth here, but there are 144,000 who will be the special ones that will get to live with God in heaven. Now, I don't see that as being descriptive of what's being talked about here. And let's see if we can draw some conclusions from this. First of all, notice that right after the things that we read in chapter 6, these different seals that were open, here, I mentioned a while ago that you have things almost kind of starting over again. And the reason that I say that is, you remember, with the sixth seal, you had some pretty dramatic things taking place. If you are talking about at a point in sometime history, not future end of the world, but sometime that's come, you have things like the sky being rolled back like a scroll. You have stars falling from heaven. Those kinds of things, if we are talking about something that happens historically, if we're not just talking about end times judgment language, or if this is not kind of the end of the cycle that then starts over in chapter 7, it'd be very difficult to even imagine that some of the things that are described at the beginning of chapter 7 could even still continue. You know, if you've got stars falling to the earth, falling from the heavens, Some of the things that are described as going on, even life upon earth still going on, would be difficult to manage. That's why I kind of think what you have here is after the sixth seal describing these dramatic judgments coming, then chapter 7 kind of starts again to describe God's care for his people, hardships that come upon the earth, but ultimate deliverance. Notice a couple things here as it describes these things that will happen and God's power to limit what will happen. And he does so so that, what does it say there? Why does he limit them in verse 3 from doing certain harm? What's it say? Right, so his servants can be sealed. Now, what do you notice about, was that first or second? That was first. What do you notice about verses 5 through 8 that is descriptive of these servants? Who are these names that are mentioned? Right, 12 tribes. And there are, you know, there are some things here that you might notice about the naming of them, some left out, some that are described a certain way. But here you'll notice that it's the Israelites that's being described. Okay. Now, can we conclude from this that this is describing the only ones that are going to go to heaven? If so, then we are just talking about those that are Israelites of the flesh. But I think, as we'll see in the next few verses, I don't think we can draw that conclusion. I think part of what is being described here, which I think would have been very important, particularly to one like John or to others in the first century who have come out of Judaism and saw their brethren reject the gospel, it would be very important for them to know there is a remnant. There are those of Israel that no matter what persecution comes, there are those of Israel that are still God's people. There are those of Israel that will be preserved, that will be delivered. There are those of Israel that will be a part of this heavenly Jerusalem. Now, before time runs out, let's read just a little bit into the next section. And this is one of the main reasons that I don't think we're talking about only 144,000 that are going to heaven. The rest are going to live on a rejuvenated earth. Would somebody read for us down to verse 12, verse 9 down through verse 12? Okay. Eddie, if you would. Okay. Now, first of all, notice that you're not just talking about only 144,000 that are here giving honor and glory and worship. Verse 9, there's a great multitude which no one could number of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues. You can't just say that this is angelic beings because it's nations and tribes and peoples and tongues. So it's human beings that are also a part of this heavenly host. Now, I think we'll stop right there because when we get to verse 13, John's going to ask a question about who these people are. And then I think it shows us conclusively that we're not just talking about 144,000 that are going to be able to be a part of the heavenly host. Chuck?
It's not just Israelites either.
That's right. That's right. All nations. Very, very good. Any final thought, comments? All right, let's pick up then verse 13 of chapter 7 next time. Thank you for your thoughts and comments.